Many millions of people are looking to the United States and NATO for leadership in this moment of unprovoked military crisis in Europe. While the commitments toward a solution our government and our voters are willing to make may be limited, the role American evangelicals have played in supporting the Russian threat growing for years in plain sight is undeniable. Chrissy Stroup holds a PhD in modern Russian history, spent years as a scholar there, and is a leading commentator on post-secular conflicts and political religion. All of this makes her the perfect expert to reach out to as we look at American culpability in the current war of Russian aggression. Chrissy, welcome back to State of Belief Radio. It's always good to have you here.
Thank you, Welton. It's always great to join you. I'd say it's a pleasure, but it's not exactly pleasant to talk about the Russia and Ukraine situation, though. No, we need to do it.
Your Religion Dispatch's article is headlined, "Russia and the U.S. Have More in Common Than You Think." You bring personal experience and observations to this piece. What are the commonalities that you identify?
First, let me say that that piece was first published in Open Democracy and then reprinted in Religion Dispatches. So some of the similarities that I bring up in this commentary have to do with the kind of hyper-patriotism of sort of ordinary individuals that we find often in the United States and in Russia, a kind of patriotism that often goes to an unhealthy degree associated with visions of national greatness. People in the Soviet Union were always told that they were growing up in the greatest country in the world. Well, we here in America were also being told, in school and on TV and 4th of July ceremonies and everywhere else that we live in the greatest country in the world. I don't even think that it's useful to talk about what is the greatest country in the world. But, we have this history of having been two sort of rival great powers. And we also both have a history, Russia and the United States, of expansion westward to the American frontier in the case of the United States and eastward through Siberia in the case of Russia, colonizing and enacting brutal violence on indigenous peoples. And I think those sort of things shape the mentality of people living in countries like that. And you have to sort of work against some of the biases that you internalize from that sort of thing. Neither Russia nor the United States wants to be particularly honest about our history. Russians also don't want to talk about the history these days of Stalinist repressions. They want to focus only on Stalin's victory in World War II. But a lot of times you just see this sort of thing, and I call it a sort of imperial provincialism, right? We've come from countries with these imperial histories, and the ordinary people who are of the sort of main ethnic group that's centered and considered to be the default in these countries, white Americans of European descent, especially Protestants, people who are ethnic Russian in the Russian state, tend to have a very myopic view of the world. Neither these kinds of Russians nor Americans particularly value learning foreign languages. And sometimes they even express aggression toward people that they hear speaking a foreign language on the street. You know, this is something that occurs in America. Some people are just walking down the street speaking Spanish or Mandarin or whatever. And some white American bigot says, "This is America. We speak English here." Well, I've seen the same exact thing happen in Russia. In fact, I've had it happen to me when I was riding Russian public transportation once in, must have been 2004, riding home from work, where I was an English teacher in Vladimir at that time with another English teacher. So both native English speakers, we both could get by in Russian. I think that was before I would really have called myself fluent, but we got by. But of course, sitting next to each other, we were speaking English. And so, well, this big Russian man in a leather jacket and buzz cut, saunters up to us and And he said, «Вы понимаете по-русски?» Which is, «Do you understand Russian?» And so we said, «Да», you know. And he starts reading us the riot acts that we're speaking English on a Russian trolley bus. And there was another time when some friends and I, American and Russian friends, were sitting together going to a local agricultural festival. We were taking a bus from Vladimir to Suzdal, a beautiful old city with gorgeous, churches and monasteries. So they have a cucumber festival every summer. I think a lot of Americans from the South and the Midwest will understand the draw of a local agricultural festival. Yeah. So we were going to the cucumber festival, and we had bought our bus tickets a little bit in advance. So we had seats on the bus, and a lot of people had standing room only. It was a crowded bus. Mm-hmm. So we're quietly talking to each other. And then here are these Russians standing next to us. And suddenly I overhear them saying in Russian, «Well, now look at these foreigners just coming here and taking our seats».
You were in Russia during the first Russian tests of Western resolve against aggression. What was that like?
Yeah, that's correct. I taught at the Russian Presidential Academy of National Economy and Public Administration. It's quite a mouthful. It's even more of a mouthful in Russian, in Moscow from 2012 to 2015, excuse me. So when Russia annexed Crimea, again, right after the Winter Olympics, in that case, the Sochi Olympics that Russia was hosting, that's when they started sending the so-called Little Green Men, listeners may remember, into Crimea, Russian soldiers not wearing insignia, to secure Crimea and take it. And of course, that was a huge violation of international law. It was pretty bloodless. But then, of course, they created these trumped up conflicts in the Donbass region of Ukraine. And that's not been bloodless at all, where, you know, these so-called breakaway people's republics, the Donetsk and Luhansk people's republics, set up military resistance to the Ukrainian government. It never had majority support among the local populations. Yeah.
How did the divisions that you saw in Russia parallel those divisions you see in the United States?
So once that happened, you know, and Russia announced at the beginning of March the annexation of Crimea, and covertly Russia-supported war began in eastern Ukraine, I watched a lot of people around me in Russia, some that I considered friends, expressed their full support for the regime. Many Russians were shouting, «Krim nash», you know, «Crimea is ours» was this big slogan. And it was really scary to just watch this sort of happening all around me. Now, I have a lot of good friends and colleagues in Russia who did not support the annexation of Crimea and do not support the war now. But some people that I really thought were reasonable and would see this as overreach certainly did not. And I guess I shouldn't have been surprised. But it did. It did shock me. And then, you know, in 2015, I was able to come home to the United States. Russia was also ramping up persecution against the LGBTQ community at that time, starting in 2012. And that was one reason that I wanted to go home. Mm-hmm. And then I get back here. I have a postdoc at the University of South Florida, and pretty much just in time to see the country elect Donald Trump and ramp up attacks against gay and trans Americans. And so I also saw a lot of people that I would have liked to think would have been better, more reasonable, more fair-minded, less hypocritical, you know, go for Donald Trump and his whole political program. And it was another sort of wake-up call. And I had that strange, disorienting experience twice in a row of, you know, wow, a lot of people around me that I thought were my real friends are ready to go fascist at the drop of a hat, it seems like.
Would you say a word or two about political religion coming into play in both countries related to the specific targeting of LGBTQI plus persons and rights in Russia and the U.S.? What are the parallels there?
Mm-hmm. There's parallels and, in fact, a lot of direct connections, because the Russian supporters of Putin and simply socially conservative Russians, Orthodox Christian Russians in particular, and the American Christian right have been collaborating at an elite level for a long time through organizations like the World Congress of Families, which has recently been renamed the World Organization for the Family, and it's currently run by Brian Brown, president of the National Organization for Marriage. Queer people are often able to be scapegoated by authoritarian people with majoritarian grievances. They're perceived as a vulnerable group that can be targeted. And in authoritarian communities, you have this real emphasis on machismo, you know, and queer people, of course, throw that just all into confusion for them. They want men to be men and women to be women, mm-hmm. and have a lot of very fixed and, I would say, pernicious ideas about what that means. It's interesting that at the beginning of the Soviet Union, you know, the early revolutionary years, there were a lot of efforts to really liberate women from patriarchy, but all that went by the wayside by the mid to late 1930s, and the Soviet regime was surprisingly patriarchal in some ways. Post-Soviet Russia is much more so, and is using Christianity to justify that patriarchal stance of women should be in their place and men should be men. And of course, that's also something that is focused on by the Christian right. You know, there's this council on biblical manhood and womanhood associated with, you know, Dr. Piper there, and people at the Gospel Coalition. They're all about complementarianism, which means that, you know, male headship of the family is the only appropriate biblical theology that you can have. They used to call it biblical patriarchy. They don't call it that as much anymore because they know it doesn't sound great. It's not good branding, but it's still it's the same thing. Yeah. And so, yeah, they've been focusing their efforts on trying to make queer people invisible again because we make them uncomfortable. And that takes the form of vicious legal persecution. Like, well, Putin has called, you know, giving transgender children access to age-appropriate medical care almost a crime against humanity, he said a few years back. And now we see the same kinds of arguments happening in states like Texas, where they actually have open child abuse investigations, trumped-up phony child abuse investigations into loving parents who are supporting their trans kids.
Yeah. Christy, I want to bring us right into today and what's on so many people's minds. There are chilling reports of thousands of Russians being detained for participating in the anti-war marches. We've seen in the major cities there. How high are the stakes for these people for promoting the actual Christian message of peace?
Very high. It'd be interesting. I'd like to take a poll, I mean, of who is in the protests, how many of them are Orthodox Christians and how many of them are secular. But yeah, I mean, certainly Christianity can make this case for peace. You're not going to see that from the hierarchs of the Orthodox Church, but you do see it from some good Russian Orthodox Christians, like my friend Sergei Chapman, who used to be the editor or one of the main editors for the official journal of the Moscow Patriarchate, you know, the journal of the Russian Orthodox Church. And he is not in Russia at this moment, which honestly I fully support. But there are a lot of brave people in Russia getting arrested. Russia's cracking down quite a bit on dissent. And in fact, the Echo Moskvy radio station, the Echo of Moscow, which has been a sort of staple of liberal commentary, pro-democratic commentary for a long time in the late Soviet space and then in post-Soviet Russia, has now been shut down. And I doubt we'll be seeing that reopened anytime soon. It was already illegal in Russia, technically, to say that Crimea is part of Ukraine, though according to any reasonable interpretation of international law, it is. And now they're also making it illegal to frame Putin's invasion of Ukraine in any terms other than those promoted by the Kremlin. So we're going back to some more hardcore authoritarianism in Russia.
Are you able to speculate about the limits of support for Putin, especially if the Ukrainian resistance stays strong, and in particular, if the West comes together in a stronger way?
That's very difficult to say, but I think Putin will probably maintain majoritarian support for the war in Ukraine for quite some time, in part because a lot of Russians, even if they're going to complain about the sanctions, about the deprivations that the sanctions will be causing, about their pensions, about inflation, yeah, Russians will complain about all that. But many of them do buy into this sort of nationalist rhetoric and the way that Putin represents NATO and the West as anti-Russian threats, and also, you know, homosexuals and trans people and all of this as, you know, threats against the Russian way of life. Ukraine has become a kind of symbol of that threat. Putin is saying Ukraine making overtures to Europe and NATO is too far, and now he's got to put Ukraine in its place. I don't know. The divisions, people who have family in Ukraine, it may make a difference in how much they support Putin in this. But I think when the notion of national humiliation comes into play, it becomes very difficult for Putin to back down, and very difficult for, you know, your typical sort of quote unquote patriotic Russians to do anything but be supportive of him.
What do our listeners need to be thinking about in terms of religion in relation to this dangerous conflict?
Well, it's complicated because Ukrainians themselves don't even agree on which church should be the proper Ukrainian church. But it's quite clear that the Russian Orthodox Church, and at least its official circles and its prelates, they are supporting this invasion. And Putin is justifying it in terms of religious history. The Byzantine Empire, the heritage there, they just took the city of Kherson, which is where the baptism of Rus occurred, right, in 988. And the traditionalism that Putin thinks is at stake in this war is something that he represents, and the Kremlin represents, as a religious value, very similarly to how the Christian right does so as well, and says that if we lose that, then we lose Western civilization. It's funny because Putin says if we lose that, we lose Russian civilization.
Kristy Stroup holds a PhD in modern Russian history and lived in Moscow for several years. Prominent ex-evangelical writer, speaker, and advocate, who is senior correspondent at Religion Dispatches and a senior research associate with the University of Innsbruck's Post-Secular Conflict Project. Her recent column, it is headlined, "Russia and the U.S. Have More in Common Than You Might Think," and we'll link to it from stateofbelief.com. Kristy, great thanks for taking the time with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Lovely to speak with you, Wilton. Thank you for having me.